Well, hi, folks. Welcome back to Naturally Adventurous. This week, it's just me, Ken, joined by our friend Zach Babbitt. He's been on the podcast before. He had a good chat with Charlie fairly recently, and a lot of folks enjoyed that podcast, and so we are happy to welcome Zach back. So today, we're going to chat mainly about Florida. I've just been in Florida for the better part of a month. Just back from that, and I guess we talked about this a little bit on the podcast, that I was going to be making this trip, and a friend of Zach's got in touch and said, oh man, Zach has some great stories from Florida, you gotta have him on. And Zach was kind enough to jump on. I guess you're just back from Ecuador?
Yep, yeah, I just got back 2 days ago from Ecuador, so happy to be home again. Have a little bit of exploring to do on the agenda for Florida now that I'm home, but yeah, it's been a lot of time away. Did Costa Rica and Ecuador kind of back to back, so it's nice to be back in Florida.
So you're actually based in Florida at the moment?
Yeah, that's not going to be too permanent. I think I'm actually going to be moving out by the end of June for an undetermined amount of time, but that was actually the plan last summer as well, and I already found myself back here. So Florida seems to keep calling my name back, so we'll see how long I manage to stay away this time.
Well, you're obviously finding enough in Florida to keep you interested. I have very mixed feelings about Florida. It's a weird place. You know, Charlie and I have talked about this on the podcast. Texas is a little bit like this too.
Yeah.
Where like the bad is really bad, but the good is really good. Like the wild places are really wild, and the places that aren't wild are like really like Miami suburbs or like oil refineries on the upper Texas coast. They're like really quite grim.
Yeah, it's a living contradiction.
Totally.
Yeah. Which I mean, also kind of gives for the main reason why some of the conservation here is so bad in Florida. We definitely have a lot of big conservation issues and a lot of threatened species that are unique to the state here. So it is alarming that the intensity of those oppositions, right, where you have these really beautiful, unique wild spaces with a lot of ecosystem diversity and a lot of plant and invertebrate and herp and bird diversity in general. And then you just have this massive metropolitan areas throughout or huge development for agriculture or golf courses or recreation in general that are consistently or constantly rather threatening those wild spaces. It's a lot like Texas in that way, for sure. Yeah, it's a funny thing to kind of note at that, how similar it is to Texas. Yet both of them are probably amongst the four or five best states in the U.S. for wildlife diversity, which is definitely a shame.
Right. Well, I mean, to their credit, or maybe it's just an accident of history, there still is a lot of great wild stuff left, and oftentimes right next to these huge cities. So there's a very weird pattern of development in these states.
Yeah.
It's not like, say, the Northeast, where people just filled everything and every corner of every, you know, most of these states was a farm at some point, and every woodlot got logged, and it's like more things were left alone. Maybe the environments were just more intimidating and less immediately useful for humans. That might be part of why some of these things were left alone.
Right. I think that's certainly the case with Florida. I think a lot of the land here, especially in South Florida, was just, the idea was, how do we even go about developing this? And when you do develop it, what do you develop it into? Because you have the Everglades taking up the majority of South Florida. So really, Miami itself was constructed on the Miami Rock Ridge, which is the main solid foundation of land that you would have for development. Everything to the west of that was wetland and river ecosystem. So yeah, developing that became much tougher, and I think it's definitely reflected. Everglades itself, the national park, is one of the five largest in the continental U.S., so excluding Alaska there. But you also have these other natural spaces that immediately border Everglades. So you have Big Cypress National Wildlife Preserve. Pardon me. So Big Cypress National Preserve. You have Collier Seminole State Park, Fakahatchee State Park, 10,000 Islands National Wildlife Refuge. A whole bunch of names. To be honest, it doesn't actually really matter all the names and where they are all located, but they do all border each other. And I think together it's about 4 million acres of preserved habitat. So to have such a huge tract of preserved wilderness right outside of one of the most populous cities in the U.S. is pretty phenomenal.
So are you based in Fort Lauderdale?
South of it. So right between Fort Lauderdale and Miami. I'm in Hollywood, Florida right now.
In that vast sprawl.
Yeah. the wilderness of golf courses.
Right. And different kind of wilderness.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Although I will say, I think I prefer Miami to most of the other Florida cities. There's a certain character to it, and as opposed to just like generic American sprawl. Now, I think there's probably a lot of that in Miami, but
right.
Yeah, Miami's got something to it, a little cachet.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of the Caribbean influence that makes it so special. I think it's some of the best food culture I've had in the U.S. is just eating around Miami. And so I guess to that point, I think it adds a lot of interesting elements to the culture down here.
Now, you're originally from New York, is that right?
Yeah, Long Island, New York, so just about an hour outside of the city.
There is a weird affinity between Miami and New York, right? I've heard it said that like the farther south you go in Florida, the more it becomes like the Northeast in some ways.
Yeah.
A lot of the people there are obviously from the Northeast.
Yeah, I could. That's definitely true. I've never heard that, but I'm kind of laughing at that because that is pretty relevant. Yeah, the further south you go, it's like once you kind of cross the threshold of Orlando and continue south, it becomes a little bit more Northeast, at least in terms of, I guess, the social aspect.
Right. The human, not the natural environments, but the human social scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the further south you go, the further north. And then like as you go north in Florida, you converge with Alabama, and then you literally do go into Alabama and way out next to the panhandle. You know, so one thing I realized on my recent trip, we spent a week down in Flamingo at the end of the road in the Glades.
Right.
And then we're mostly based in Orlando, and then we spent quite a bit of time in the panhandle. And I just realized that Florida is a bloody enormous state. I'd never fully appreciated, you know, it's this lanky, weird shape. It's not like Texas that is just obviously massive, but wow, like if you drove from Key West to Pensacola, I don't know how many hours that would be, but it would be more than 10, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. But then on the flip side, the width of it going, you know, east to west is really thin. So it's the only place that I know where I can go do sunrise photography and sunset photography on the ocean on both
right.
sides.
And not be on an island somewhere.
Exactly, which is really enjoyable when I was doing a lot of shorebird photography. So yeah, kind of like an interesting note to make. But yeah, as you're going north to south or vice versa, it is a really long journey. And driving through Florida from the south and trying to leave can feel a little bit like a fever dream at times. It just keeps going on and on. And you're like, oh, another RV park or another Walmart parking lot. But then
another Publix.
Another Publix.
Another little development next to the Publix. And
Yeah. Which can be a little depressing sometimes, especially when you get super into the natural history of Florida and you realize, oh my gosh, this ecosystem in particular is really almost completely gone, or all this development here is just absolutely destroying things that are south of it. So you can kind of it's easy to fall into the pessimistic mindset. I'm trying not to this year. But I definitely found myself last year getting a little sad by some of the conservation states. But on the flip side of that, I appreciated your perspective you had, which is correct. A lot of the northeastern states, there really is almost nothing left. So if you kind of compare that, Florida does have a lot of land in comparison to some of the other states. So it's good to be grateful for what we have left.
Yeah.
But it's relatively new in terms of geologically speaking, compared to a lot of the other states. And so it's kind of gone through these very different periods of being below the surface of the ocean and above the surface, going between these interglacial and glacial periods in time. And the central part of Florida has really only been above the ocean for 4 to 2.5 million years consistently above. And a lot of that is in Central Florida, where we have some of our higher elevation. You kind of have to take that a bit like a the bit of a grain of salt when we say high elevation in Florida. There's not much to, I think the highest peak is Britton Hill. It's maybe 120 feet.
Which, such a flat state.
Yeah, I think Hill is being a little generous. I think Britton Bump might be a little more accurate. But that's why a lot of the unique or endemic wildlife in Florida is concentrated more in the central part of it, because that's been above the surface the longest. It's had the longest time for species to evolve. Whereas a lot of South Florida, it's really cool wildlife, but a lot of Southern Florida and the Keys is to my understanding at least, more been colonized through Caribbean wildlife over time. So you get a lot more of these Caribbean ecosystems in the continental U.S., which is super special. But in the grander scheme, it's not as unique as, say, Central Florida, for example.
Right. So Central Florida is more authentically Floridian from a biological perspective, whereas the South is more like a sort of impoverished Caribbean, in a way, I guess, although the Everglades is quite special in its own right, isn't it? Quite unique.
Right. I'd say all of it really is, too. There is a certain marvel to seeing flourishing Caribbean ecosystems in the U.S. There's nowhere else you're going to see that. We have tropical hardwood hammocks, which are unbelievable. So you get a lot of those Caribbean species like cocoa plum and gumbo limbo. Yep, exactly. Great. Exactly. Yeah, that's another great tree there. And you get wild lime, which is another cool species. And there's plenty I'm not mentioning. But, you know, the birds kind of reflect that as well. When it comes to bird watchers coming to Florida, if you haven't birded the Caribbean or South America, Florida is a really exciting place, right? It's the only place in the continental U.S. that we consistently get birds like snail kite or, you know, limpkin consistently, or white-crowned pigeon, which is probably my favorite Florida bird. We get white-crowned pigeon, but that's a Caribbean species, but it's special if you're an ABA lister or a U.S. lister, right? Because that's your only place you're going to get it. Black-whiskered vireo, kind of the same deal, mangrove cuckoo.
Right.
So these are...
Right, short-tailed hawk.
Yep, exactly. Short-tailed hawk is another great example. We only have one endemic full species. We have a few endemic subspecies, but only one full endemic species, which is Florida scrub jay, which kind of to the original point is, again, that's going to be more in Central Florida. And if not in Central Florida, it does have a real dependency on those scrub oakland habitats, which would have been your higher elevation areas. So again, the ones that have been isolated for a longer amount of time and above the ocean surface. Does that make sense? Am I explaining that?
Oh, yeah. That's I'm thinking this through, and I actually didn't realize that was the sort of Refugio Central Florida, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's really neat, and the herps reflect that as well. You get... Yeah, so if you're going for... I mean, I'll be honest, it's a real pain in the ass to find some of these endemic Florida herps. It's super tricky. Because this scrub habitat is very xeric. It's a very dry environment. And a lot of the substrate is this sandy soil. So as a result, you get a lot of these endemic herps end up being fossorial or semi-fossorial. And for anybody who might be listening who doesn't know what that means, it kind of reflects off the word fossil. It just means they spend the majority of their life underground. So you get animals like Florida sand skink, for instance, which is this fossorial lizard the limbs are pretty much vestigial now, though they do have these little nubs. And it's completely unique to the sandy environments of Florida, but it's almost impossible to find. It's one of my biggest nemesis is down here. I can't seem to find this skink anywhere. Short-tailed king snake is another great example. I'm not sure if are you a bit of a herp nerd or?
I really like herps, although I've mainly herped in Madagascar. That's where I got into it,
right.
And I haven't done a ton in the States, and I really don't know a lot about the scene in Florida as far as herps.
So Florida's fantastic. Just to kind of give a bit of an overview on why herping in Florida is great, it's the only tropic and subtropic zone in the continental U.S. So you can herp year-round, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Here. you can kind of make a point for herping at, you know, non-typical times of year in other parts of the U.S., like in the Northeast, you can start herping in March for salamander migration when you get a lot of the ambystomas like spotted salamander or Jefferson salamander, when they kind of start fluctuating towards vernal pools to breed. But Florida, you can find snakes year-round by road cruising or by flipping. So it's really, that alone makes it a really desirable place if you're into herping to kind of be, because again, it can be productive year-round. And it's a bit of a mutt in terms of the herp defauna's diversity. So in both a good way and a bad way, Northern Florida around like Gainesville and even up until Orlando, you get a lot of the herp defauna, which is, you know, the amphibians and the reptile diversity for people listening who might not know. A lot of that Northern Florida herp defauna is more reflective of the Southeast as a whole. So you get species that might be in Georgia or in Alabama, for instance. And then as you start moving further into like the central Florida sandier soil xeric habitats, you get stuff that's more unique to Florida, more endemic, like gopher tortoise or Florida sand skink or short-tailed king snake, for instance. We have actually a worm lizard down here. Are you familiar with this group, or have you heard of them before?
No.
Oh my gosh, they're so cool. It's this separate group of reptiles. They're called the oh my gosh, the Latin pronunciation is miserable. I think it's amphibanin. It doesn't. You'll have to excuse me, but if you look up worm lizard, you'll find it. It's this weird little group of reptiles that are completely fossorial. So it's different than legless lizards, which are mm-hmm. lizards that have evolved to lose the limbs. These ones, it's a similar story, but they have this very uncanny resemblance to earthworms. You should look it up at some point. Very weird. And there's actually one genus in Mexico that still has the forelimbs, but every other genus in the world, and they do have a worldwide distribution, they're not in Australia, but I believe you can find some in Asia, Africa, and then in the Neotropics, so in Central and South America. But the only one in the continental U.S. is this Florida worm lizard. So I went on a little bit of a ramble there, but my point is that, again, another unique herp that, in terms of the broader diversity throughout the whole continent, that makes it really special. There's not any other worm lizard representative in the continental U.S., so you have that, and then, you know, then we have other herps like gopher frogs are there. I could keep going. I'm going to stop myself there.
Is it the best place in the States for herping, would you say?
It depends what you want. It really does. I'd say like, it's
for,
there.
From a birding perspective, yeah. It's definitely not the best state for birding.
It's not, no.
It's an interesting place for birding. It's not the best.
Right.
Probably Texas would be the best if you're just, yeah. You know, you have to pick one state, right?
I agree. I think Arizona's my favorite, but Texas is the best.
Right.
Yeah.
So would Florida be in a similar zone for herps, or is it high in diversity and, you know, localized or endemic species?
It's a bit of a mix. Yeah, it's certainly up there. You know, it's funny. I'd say the three or four best states for birds are almost the same for herps, except for Florida, because I wouldn't really put Florida as one of the five best states for birds, but it certainly is
right.
One of the three best for herps. But the other states that were like Arizona would be up there for herps as well. Texas would be up there. California would be up there.
Right.
Texas really, because it's just a monster, right? You get all this eastern right. diversity, and then the western desert diversity, and then you get all of these really amazing herps that are not in the U.S. other than South Texas. You kind of have that same effect happening where, you know, in the U.S. you're not going to see green jay anywhere outside of the Rio Grande Valley, or at least pretty limited to the Rio Grande Valley. And then the same is going to be reflected with some of the herps there. You can get Tamaulipan milk snake. You can get speckled racer in South Texas. So Texas is pretty special overall for wildlife diversity. Florida, I would definitely say, is up there, though, for the herp diversity as well. You just have a lot of diversity in the north, again, that's reflective of the southeast. You get some of the more unique ones in the center. And then South Florida, South Florida doesn't have that many endemic herps is the only thing. It has a lot of invasive herps. that's the big problem also, right?
These famous pythons that everyone loves to talk about.
Oh my gosh, those burn. I actually saw, I got a good Florida story for you. I was taking a group on a hike, and it's one of those things people always, are we going to see the Burmese pythons? It's like, no, we're not going to see the Burmese. It's not happening. It never happens. And then it did happen. One time I was doing a walk with a group, and some guy was coming down the trail the opposite way, and he said, oh, there's a snake at the end of the trail. And that's all he said. So I just like assumed it would be like a water snake or a cottonmouth or something. And when I got to the end of the trail, there was a 10-foot Burmese python with a wood stork halfway down its mouth. Yeah, which was really sad. Not to laugh at the morbidness of it, but somebody asked me if the stork was going to be okay. And it was not. I was like, not every bone in that stork's body is crushed. But we did get the ranger down there, and it was kind of fun. We got to watch a proper python extraction happen. So they got the snake out, which was great at least. So the stork didn't make it, but the snake was euthanized. And that's very much the protocol now when it comes to Burmese pythons. It's a bit of an issue that's out of control. Our native mammals here in the Everglades have dropped anywhere from 70 to 80, 90%, depending on which type of mammal you're talking about. So raccoons, I think, have dropped an average of 85% their populations in South Florida. The only place I've seen them really is in Miami or some of these more suburban or even urban environments. And otters, I think it's a similar statistic, around 70 or 75% the populations have dropped in these areas that the Burmese pythons are now found in. I know for Big Cypress National Preserve, the marsh rabbit population is considered right now completely extirpated from Big Cypress. And so that's very alarming. And we also have, I don't know how into mammals or squirrels you are, but there's a really neat subspecies of fox squirrel in Big Cypress, very appropriately named Big Cypress fox squirrel. And so that one its population has been a very steady decline because that subspecies is only found in areas that overlap now with Burmese pythons. So it's another very unfortunate thing. And these Burmese pythons are really a marvel of evolution in every way. These females can lay, the average is closer to 40, 50, but they're more than capable of laying up to 100 eggs. And so the Burmese pythons, they're an oviparous species, so they're actually laying the eggs themselves. It's not like rattlesnakes, which are ovoviparous, meaning they'll have the egg inside and then it hatches before the baby's born, so it comes out looking like a live birth. That's what rattlesnakes do. But in the case of the Burmese pythons, they have their nest, they'll protect the nest, and then once the babies hatch, they're around 18 to 24 inches, so they're already larger than most of the native snakes here in South Florida. So there's already that lack of predation, if you will. And then they're able to over, trying to think of the best way to describe it, but there's not much threat of competition from native snakes either. They're able to definitely go for larger prey items that native snakes are not going for. So there's not many checks and balances in place, naturally speaking, right, for these Burmese pythons. And another little fun fact for you on them is that the females are more than capable of parthenogenesis, which means that in an emergency, a genetic emergency, the female's able to clone herself.
Incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible, except in the native range, they don't seem to be capable of any of this. They're just being decimated by poaching. But here,
exactly. I've never seen a Burmese python in the places where they belong.
Yeah, it's all, unfortunately, the poaching for the skin, for handbags, and it's so sad. And, the hopeful young conservationist in me is like, oh, if only we could figure out a way to send some back. But that it's just not realistic. Right. That'll never – who's going to pay for that, We got to turn Jeff Bezos into a snake lover and then –
Yeah, and you imagine like shipping these snakes to the other side of the world and then dumping them into some ecosystem like they're not familiar with it. And
yeah. And then
are they going to even recognize what they should be eating or how it would survive there? Like,
what might diseases? Go to all that
trouble and it might not even work. Yeah.
Yeah. What maybe what disease are they bringing over now? So there's just way too many ifs, ands, and buts when it comes to relocating these Floridian pythons to their native range. And I think it's Myanmar mostly. It would have been Burma. So I think Myanmar is now what Burma was. Isn't that true?
Right. That, yeah, that's the official name. Both are sort of acceptable as I understand it, but
okay.
Yeah, it's weird. It makes me wonder what does keep them in balance in Burma, Myanmar? You know, what's so different there? Why haven't they decimated mammals there? Maybe there's more bigger snakes there that compete with them more.
It's king cobras is their predator.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So king cobras get to about 16 feet in length, and so there's a lot more predation happening on young Burmese pythons. I would imagine, at least, that's what I've read, is that the presence of their predator, king cobras, in Burma is what keeps them naturally checked. I don't think anybody's going to want to reintroduce king cobras here to South Florida.
It's clearly the solution.
Yeah, right. That's exactly it. We'll do the old the cane toad approach. Oh, we have all these cane crickets. Let's bring in some toads. What could go wrong? Yeah, rest in peace to the qual. But So in their natural environment, the king cobras are kind of there. Here, again, you know, 18 to 24 inches, that's larger than most native snakes. Our largest native snake we have here in Florida is eastern indigo, and that caps out at around 9.5 feet. And to be completely honest, they're not even really hitting that anymore. Those are more historic length numbers. Whereas a Burmese python, when it's fully grown, is hitting more 18 to 24 feet. So, huge difference. Burmese python, I think, is considered the third or fourth largest snake in the world. So, it's once they surpass a certain length, there's really nothing that's going to be hunting them. I mean, they're more than capable of taking some of the smaller gators out. A lot of our mammals are certainly falling victim. I haven't been able to read anything about, you know, panthers being predated on by the pythons, like pythons eating panthers, but I'm sure it's happening to some degree.
Wow.
Yeah. So, sorry.
You imagine cubs at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm thinking more than anything. Though I'm sure, I mean, these Burmese pythons are real titans. They're an amazing animal and they're beautiful. It's not their fault they're here, but unfortunately they are. And so euthanization is the main way. And I mentioned earlier that when we got this snake removed and the rangers euthanized it, that's the, you know, there's definitely a check system to euthanizing these pythons now. You can't just go out with your in your pickup truck and with your shotgun and take out a few snakes. You need a license is how they do it now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I'm not allowed to go out and just kill pythons. In fact, if I'm found with a dead python, I can be in a lot of trouble. I think the main reason is you probably had a lot of yahoos going out and killing these snakes, and they weren't trained, and so they were just killing native endangered species like eastern diamondback, right. And they don't know what's right and what's wrong. So I think that's the state's way of managing to make sure you don't just have this kind of this free-for-all onslaught of our snakes. Yeah.
I had the impression, maybe incorrect, that it was that way at some point, and there was just like a carte blanche for killing these things, and there were these like massive snake hunts and stuff, but maybe they've pulled back from some of those policies.
Yeah, I think it's become more restricted over the years. 'Cause that was my impression of it too, from when I first looked into it years ago, but since getting here, and I wanted to get into it, and no, it's pretty strictly managed. The other thing is the way you kill them, even though the snake is not actually a protected species. All animals in the state of Florida are protected by the Anti-Animal Cruelty Act. So you can't just run it over like five times and throw it in the back. Like, that's not only unethical to the animal, but it's illegal. What you're doing is, you know, like the livestock rod guns. I'm trying to remember the proper name.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yep. You use that. You hit it in the center of the skull. So it doesn't, ideally, it doesn't suffer at all. And then I think you get like $50 for the first 3 feet and then an additional $25 per foot is what you make as a poacher or as a python hunter.
If you have a license to bounty hunt Burmese pythons.
Exactly. If you have a license.
Are there some full-time people in that line of work?
There are. Yeah, apparently, I don't know exactly the rate, but I think the state of Florida, if you're an official python hunter and you're registered doing it full-time, you actually make an hourly wage, even if you're not finding pythons. That's been my understanding on the subject, is that wow. I don't know what the minimum wage is or what that set wage is in Florida, but I've heard from a few people who are friends of mine who do full-time python hunting, that they make money regardless. But it's important to note, it's not on the weight of the snake, right? This thing is eating so much in the ecosystem, it kind of becomes the trash bin. So it's not, you can't really eat the snake, unfortunately. There's too much mercury content in the meat. So more than anything, it's about utilizing the skin for purses or for bags or whatever, wallets or other sorts of, I don't know why I'm blanking on the word right now, but yeah, you can use the skin. And then I think there's been people who are selling reconstructed skeletons. That's got to have some money to it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is kind of cool. Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. But yeah, it's funny. I think some of the locals eat the meat and they're like, I feel fine. But it's like, that's not how mercury poisoning works. You're right. Not going to feel it like 2 hours later.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, anyways, so the pythons are definitely an interesting subject. We probably shouldn't talk about it the entire time, but yeah, as much as I'd like to.
It's all very Florida. Just like we've touched on many aspects in which Florida is just an odd place, and the pythons just fit right in. You kind of cracked me up, too. You mentioned a couple herping terms there, which was like road cruising and flipping. And I was just thinking, these sound like very underworld terms. Like, it sounds it's like okay, just another day in the life of a Florida herper.
Yeah.
So your friend who suggested that we do this podcast told me about you have a lot of good stories, and even just mentioned some of them in passing. So I suggest we get into those if you're up for it.
Yeah, totally. So more than anything, I mean, when I came here, we talked a little bit about the lack of bird diversity, right? And I've been a birder for about 5 or 6 years now and really interested in photographing as many birds as possible. So when I moved down to Florida for like 9 months, I was like, what am I going to do? Because, right. You know, there's not as much diversity. And the wintertime, it's like, okay, well, I can't go for mangrove cuckoo, can't go for black-whiskered vireo. Can't go for some of these other species. So I had to keep myself busy. So I kind of when I was living in Florida back in 2022, I kind of rediscovered this love of herping I had. It kind of got sidelined for a little bit as I got much more into birding, but herping was originally my passion. I thought I was going to be an amphibian biologist when I was in college. So I had all this time and I just got really back into herping, and I actually found this love for orchids and invertebrates. So I mean, you know, spending a lot of time in South Everglades, you kind of have to spend a lot of time down there to do a lot of the herping justice. So road cruising is like a pretty classic herping technique, right? And yeah, it is like underground slang now that you say that. Yeah, usually it's not as epic as it sounds. It usually includes getting some like really crappy fast food and then just driving for like 4 hours until 2 a.m. and being absolutely sleep deprived, and all you found was like a mud, not a mud snake, but like a brown snake. It wasn't worth the effort usually. But sometimes it is. So when I first started down in South Florida doing the Everglades road cruising, I'd always have my tongs with me, and I didn't actually realize it, but it's like completely illegal to have tongs with you. So the idea was never to like harass venomous snakes with them, but if I'm driving and there's like a cottonmouth crossing the road or a rattlesnake, I want to be able to help the little one get from one side to the other so it doesn't get hurt from any other incoming traffic. So I unfortunately found out the wrong way. I was in South Glades, and I lost my mind. There was a dusky pygmy rattlesnake right in the middle of the road. And this was a snake I've wanted to see for years. This is the smallest rattlesnake in the world. Which is kind of funny because in South Florida, we only have two rattlesnakes. It's the Eastern Diamondback, which is the largest in the world, and the Dusky Pygmy, which is the smallest. Nothing in between.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, weird.
The two extreme ends. So I just like immediately like shot off to the side of the road, and I'm like running out, and like I had like a bathing suit. So I got this like bright pink little short thing on that was really obnoxious, and I'm like barefoot running out to this like rattlesnake. With my tongs in hand, and the I'm like there was this car speeding down that was coming down, so I'm like trying to signal for them to stop, and it's this Italian couple, and they're like, "Che cosa fai? Sei pazzo?" And I'm like, no, è sta un vipera, and I was trying to like explain to them about the snake, and then I pulled it off to the side and got the snake. And was showing it to them, and it found out actually they lived about 10 minutes away from where my family was from in Italy. So I'm like, I was standing on the road just absolutely, oh, I had no shirt on too. It was really obnoxious. The whole outfit was a little ridiculous. Yeah. So
really Florida man.
It was Florida really Florida. Yeah, it was like pink shorts and a rattlesnake. It's like, that's all I was rocking.
What are you wearing today?
Yeah. It was my rattlesnake uniform. And just kind of hanging out on the side, talking to this couple in practicing my Italian a little bit. And then the ranger comes up and informed me that I was breaking the law with the tongs. And I'm just like trying to explain to him, like, listen, like, I love snakes. Like, I'm not poaching. I just wanted to help him across the road. And he's like, well, even if you is that's it, like, you can't actually move them across the road. Like, so I'm like just supposed to let it die? Like, you know, like, you could stop the car, but the snake's going to sit there for 40 minutes. It's not like really going to – I'm not going to start a roadblock for this rattlesnake. I'm just going to move him. So anyways, I think it was a mix of protocol. I don't think he didn't believe me, but he ended up taking an entire check through my whole car. We had to take everything out of my car because he wanted to make sure I didn't have snakes and herps and stuff down here. Which that is an issue. A lot of people are poaching down here, which is really a shame.
Collect them for pets or whatever, pet trade.
Yeah, it's absolutely foul, and unfortunately, that's why herpers. It's a bit more of a gatekeeping community than birding.
Yeah,
you don't really tell people your spots unless you like really trust them. Yeah, I mean, I met this guy who was telling me at the beginning he was really into turtles, and I was like, oh, that's awesome, like I love turtles, like we should go look for turtles. And I ended up going over his house. I've reported him since, but this guy had like an entire wildlife trafficking thing out of his house. He had well over 100 turtles on the property. He had like 20 or 30 diamondback terrapins, which are a super endangered turtle. He has been selling them for pets. Yeah, and it's really tragic.
This is a weird, like, hoarding thing that seems to grip some herpers. It's like the dark side of herping.
It is. It's like this weird, like, need to own and possess things. Right. I don't get it. It's like, take a picture.
Yeah, birding, you know, egging was a huge thing, right, for probably 100 plus years, maybe longer, especially in Britain. So, you know, it's maybe in a similar vein, like it's not enough to see it, I want to possess some part of this creature.
It's true. And it, to be honest, it's more reflective of people in general than those hobbyists in specific. People,
right,
I think a lot of people tend to have this weird possessiveness that they, you know, we confuse our love or infatuation for something and mistake it for, okay, well, I love it, so I want it. And it's a very unfortunate connection people make, unfortunately. Again, that kind of is very common in herping, is you get a lot of people that poach or they keep, and you even have states where it's actually not illegal to keep herps, but you don't really want to be sharing that information regardless. You know, like in Colorado, you can in season kill prairie rattlesnakes, and you can keep some of the reptiles in the state of Colorado as a pet. That doesn't mean just because it's legal I'm going to share any of that information. You know, if you're really into herping, you still want to maintain these wild populations. You don't want to risk anybody going in and absolutely clearing house on them. And
so you don't think eHerp is going to take off anytime soon?
No!
It's never going to be as open source as birding has become.
No, it's such a shame too, because it's like, for me, I'm just like, I travel so much usually, so it's like very hard to establish yourself with these locations that are for herping. Birding on the go and moving around is a lot easier, but moving around a lot and herping is much trickier, right? Because you really kind of have to make your own connections or really explore an area to a depth that takes way more than a few weeks. I don't know. It's a tough community to really nestle yourself in. So every once in a while when I meet a herper, I'm like kind of trying to get some information. I'm like, hey, you don't have like a lesser, you know, an Everglades siren spot, do you? Which I'm very good about never sharing that information with anybody else, but it's definitely a little bit of a word of mouth game for the herps. There's a lot of good ones to get down here.
Well, and it's weirdly disproportionate, right, in that you're trying to get information from somebody, but on the condition that you'll never share that with anyone else. And there, you know, it's kind of counter to the spirit in which it's offered.
Yeah.
It's a weird,
it's true. And the other thing is, it's like, I feel like most people who are into herping have had a bad experience sharing information, whether it was the person you gave mm-hmm. the info to. I think everybody who's into herping has had a time they go to their spot and like everything's flipped and nothing's put back in place. And you're like, what the hell happened here? Because that's the other thing, right? There's like herping etiquette. You don't go to a spot and then, you know, if all your logs are the wrong way and the people didn't put the debris back, that spot is trash now for a little while.
Is there a term for that, like a one-way flip or like a...
I don't know. There like, should
man,
be.
Man, this guy was flipping and he didn't this guy, flip yeah. it back.
This guy's flipping the wrong way. Yeah, I don't know. There should be a term for it.
There should be.
Yeah. That's too funny, though.
Yeah, herping, we could do a whole podcast just kind of comparing the worlds of herping with birding.
With birding,
very
yeah.
similar in some ways and very different in other ways. But
right.
I can see how you got into that down there. I mean, that's basically how I got into herps in Madagascar. It's just, well, I've seen all these birds a lot of times. There's very little migration. There's low diversity. But I still like nature. And actually, my first natural history love was snakes. So, like you, I guess. Like and when I was like 6 years old, I just thought snakes and lizards were awesome.
Yeah, they're so cool. How could you not?
They are.
Yeah, they're
exactly. That's my position.
Yeah. No, and it's funny, as I've gotten older, I've gotten more into frogs and salamanders. I switched teams for sure. But yeah, the amphibians are absolutely fantastic. Again, kind of in that same vein, it's funny. You'd think South Florida would be great for amphibians, but it's really not. It's not that great. A lot of our native frogs have been decimated by invasive frogs like Cuban tree frog. Mm. And then the other problem is, I mean, there's a real lack of salamander diversity. The ones we do have are almost completely aquatic, which reflects the type of ecosystem you have down here in South Everglades, right? Or in South Florida.
Kind of right. Seasonal, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, we have Everglades dwarf siren. We have greater siren down here. So the sirens are this family of salamanders that are almost completely, or I should say they are completely aquatic. I'm trying to remember. Actually, it's... Yeah, they do have four limbs, but they're very small limbs, the sirens. Whereas amphiumas, which is another family of salamanders, have no hind limbs. They just have the front limbs. So again, we have two-toed amphiuma, greater siren, Everglades dwarf siren. The only classic salamander, when you think of a salamander, what would come to mind is probably the peninsula newt, which is a subspecies of the spotted newt. So not a full species down here either. But again, I've had kind of like hit or miss luck with these amphibians targeting for them. The thing I got really into while I was in Florida, aside from the herps, actually was going for invertebrates. Are you into butterfly watching at all?
I was fanatical about it in the States and Mexico for a few years. And then I really got into it in Madagascar. I haven't yet taken it up again in the States,
right.
But I think I will. I love it.
It's a lot of fun. It's a great way to if you go birding for the day and it's completely unproductive, it's a great way to come back and still feel like you did something, right? Because if the birds aren't biting, the butterflies are flying. It's a fantastic thing. So South Florida has these four endemic butterflies, but because of the long history of all the all the insecticide use for mosquitoes down here. Those four butterflies, our four unique ones, are all critically endangered. So we have Miami blue, which is really not doing well. It's completely extirpated from its native range. It's now only found in I think it's Big Pine Key is what it's called, but at like Bahia Honda State Park. And then the only other one, the other one is Bartram Scrub Hair Streak, which was this like Miami Rock Ridge specialist. It's really only found in a few parks now. It's like South Everglades National Park. And then this one other little adjacent pineland, it's pretty much extirpated everywhere else. It's the same area for Florida leafwing. And then lastly, the other one is Shoss's Swallowtail. It's the other one of the four. And of the four, that's the only one I've managed to see, is that Shoss's Swallowtail. Wow.
Despite living in that Miami area.
Yeah, and trying pretty regularly for these butterflies when they were supposed to be in their flight season. You definitely have to keep in mind there's certainly a factor of variability depending on how much rainfall has happened that year and these other elements. But I was looking on iNaturalist. There were very few, maybe one or two reportings for each of those other three for all of last year. So it's really not looking good. But the Shoss's Swallowtail was very abundant. That was another one. I was clicking my ankles when I saw this thing. I was so excited. It looks a lot.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, you just like going time and time again to Key Largo, and you're just getting like decimated by mosquitoes almost every time there. And you're like, why do I care about butterflies? You like question the whole point of it. But then you see this animal, it's absolutely worth it. It's such a cool experience to see this critically endangered large swallowtail just kind of perusing through its native environment. And it's really only now restricted to Key Largo. It used to be throughout South Florida and a few of the other keys. It's only on this one key now. But yeah, so the butterflies were definitely a group I got really into. I don't know if you're into spiders at all, but man, there's one spider in particular that's just absolutely jaw-dropping here in Florida. There's a number of them, but there's one in particular. Have you gotten into this at all, like spiders or any these other invertebrates or anything?
Not much, and definitely not in Florida.
Okay, so I've got one if you're interested to check out next time you're here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's one of the widows. So there's five widows in North America. And widow spiders are the ones belonging to the genus Lactrodectus. So you've got your classic southern, northern, and western black widow. Those are the classic ones people would think. The female is pitch black with the larger abdomen. She's got that beautifully classic red hourglass. So those are the three of them are kind of more than anything told apart from range. There's a few minor differences, but again, this is not a spider podcast, so I'm gonna refrain from getting too into it.
Hey, it's a nature podcast.
It's a nature podcast. No, okay. Well, the northern and southern, it's actually about the two tips of the hourglass touching or being separate is how you tell those two apart. Western, I think, is more of a range thing. There's one trait I can't remember, so you'll have to forgive me on that, but brown widow is one of the other members of this genus. So again, there's five in the U.S. That's the fourth one. But then the fifth one is the red widow. And this red widow, Lactrodectus bishopi, is a central Florida endemic. It's only found here in the peninsula, and it's a classic scrub specialist species. So you're only finding this spider at the very edges of these scrub and saw palmetto leaves in this, again, in this very dry environment that's pretty much just characterized by scattered oaks, some slash pine, and then a lot of just scrub plants that are much lower to the ground. So this red widow is only in this environment. It pretty much, I think, specializes on tortoise beetles is really what it's mostly eating. And the effect of its venom is not really known. There hasn't been any instances of it biting a person. It's a timid. Most of these, all these spiders are timid. You really only get bit when you put your fingers in, you can't see them, and you accidentally grab one in a wood pile.
Right.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen with red widow because it's only going to be on the very edges of these palmetto leaves. But it's a very fun process looking for this spider because you're kind of just going out in this scrub, and you want to go earlier in the morning when it's like very backlit, the sun is just rising, and you're kind of looking for like these very dainty little little portions of spider webs kind of hanging on the edges of the plants. Because widows make a very sloppy web. It's not your classic like orb weaver web. It's a very like poorly put together. It almost looks like a web that's been abandoned for a while, if that makes sense. So you're kind of just going out and just checking all of these palm and these palmetto bushes and hoping you find one. But it's such a cool experience when you finally do, because these are just absolutely gorgeous spiders. And unfortunately, again, endangered, the spider kind of falls into the same problem that herps have, where it's like, I don't tell many people where to find this, because people have this weird fixation of either owning them or wanting to pin them for an insect collection. And I don't know, it's definitely tragic, but it's another good example. I was very excited when I found that. That was a spider that I was interested in probably since like 6th or 7th grade when I first heard of them. So I was pretty thrilled when I finally found that thing. Took enough time to find it, my goodness.
Those are always the most satisfying ones, when you've like deeply invested and dreamed of seeing something and then you finally see it. It's not the same as if like, oh, I'm going to hire Zach for a day trip to go find me the widow or whatever. And then, oh, there it is, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. And that can be really satisfying, especially if you've known the existence of the animal for a while. But that long process of like becoming aware of something and then figuring out its habits and then finding it
right.
is so satisfying.
Yeah. And, it's also, it's different, because it's like not with birding where you're learning the vocalizations and these smaller invertebrates or even the herps, you're like, you have to learn plant identification
right.
oftentimes to really nail down the spot for it, and so many other factors. But then I got into orchids too, so I spent a lot of time out in that scrub central habitat, just like kind of trolling through and trying to find like Florida dancing lady orchid and butterfly orchids down there. A little bit more north you get green flies, but Florida, again, it seems to be one of the best states for everything except birds. it's really good for, it's definitely great for birds too. I'm not trying to say it's not, but in terms of unique diversity, the orchids are very special. The herps are very special. The butterflies and the other invertebrates are very special.
So I guess it sounds like there's a couple stories and a whole experience surrounding looking for and finding flamingos during the recent American flamingo event.
Yes.
You want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, this is before the you're referring to the huge influx of American flamingos we just recently had this year, right?
Yeah. So this was prior to that?
This is prior to that. So what had happened was, this is in October 2022 when it kind of started. So when I first moved to Florida, I'm trying to remember the name of the hurricane, but we had just recently had a hurricane, and I arrived like one day after the hurricane finished. Perfect timing. So I was just kind of getting settled in, and I was like, okay, I first got there, I'm like, what birds can I focus? This is again, like right as I got there, before I reignited my love of herping and invertebrates and all of this other stuff. So I was like, what bird can I try and focus in on? And I was thinking about how you definitely get these influxes of flamingos arriving and other vagrants, often correlated to tropical storms happening in Florida. Because if the winds are coming from the right area, it's very intense. And if you get a few that are blown offshore, they're not trucking through those winds that are going the opposite direction. They're going to the closest land that it brings them to.
Right.
So I was looking at maps and I realized that there's this area in South Florida called Snakebite, and it was almost perfectly aligned with a lot of portions of Cuba. So I was thinking, well, there was a big storm. I looked at the eBird hotspot, and nobody had been down there for at least a month and a half. So I was thinking, if a flamingo is right now in Florida, this is going to be the place it is. Or it's probably going to be here, because the other thing about this bay, Snakebite, that I had seen on the map, I looked into it, and it was one of the largest seagrass beds, which is another great habitat indicator that, okay, this could be perfect for having flamingos present, because you get the seagrass and you get the brine shrimp coming in, and if you have brine shrimp, then it's perfect. You have your food base for all the flamingos. So I trucked down, and I got off on the boat, and it was a great, absolutely amazing paddle. This was just me by myself, and I actually did find these flamingos. I found three American flamingos down there, And that was my life, where it was such a cool experience.
And you're in a kayak.
And I was in a kayak. Or... Yeah, yeah. I took my sea kayak. So I had to paddle like 6 miles to get to this place. It was a lot of fun. It's actually, the seagrass bed also doubles as a shark nursery. So you just have these like little lemon sharks zipping around. And it's a pretty unbelievable area in terms of natural history and wildlife diversity for South Florida. Then I have a big love of sharks as well. So it was funny, during the low tide here, there's these canals that are a little bit deeper. And during the low tide, you have to go there so you don't get stranded. A lot of the bait fish will go there as well. And I ended up finding a pretty large bull shark there, about like 8 or 9 feet. And I kept egging him on. I was like, I was tapping my hand in the water like an injured fish next to the boat, trying to get him to come in close. There were a few times I snuck a few pets on the tail. It was really, really a beautiful day. But yeah, to see the flamingos was unbelievable. So I kind of walked away. So that's like the first part to this story, right? It was like a really successful trip. So two of my best friends in the world, Noah and Nick, they were planning on coming to visit in Florida. They were coming in January, and I was telling them about this. Like, we should try and get the flamingos, because neither of them had seen the American flamingos. And it gets a little bit closer to the time that they're coming down, and I saw somebody post some flamingos on Instagram. I was like, hey, where did you get this? And it happened to be the same spot. So I'm like, that's awesome. They're hanging around. So once my friends got there, we got to Florida. We planned this whole day around going for the flamingos. And to be completely honest, it became a bit of a disaster of a day, but in the best way possible. So we left. I'm trying to remember. It doesn't really matter the exact time, but we left pretty early in the morning. And we did the whole paddle down there, and we got the snake bite. And there was no flamingos. There was nothing around there. We just kept searching, and there was nothing in the main area. But the bite itself, I think, is about 11 miles across. So there's a lot of area to cover. So, you know, you kind of have this, all right, let's just keep going. Like, just a little bit longer. It's got to be there eventually. So we just kept going, and I think it was a combination of us not wanting to give up, which was great. And then I made a pretty big mistake is what happened. We were supposed to paddle the day before, so I looked at the tides for that day before. But then we changed plans, and I just forgot to look at the tides for the next day.
Right.
And I assumed they would be the same or similar enough. And they were not. They were super different. So what ended up happening was, we made it almost all the way across to the other side of snake bite, and there's no flamingos. We've seen like American crocodiles at this point, bunch of other birds. It was a fantastic day, but like the water, we're like realizing that low tide, which we thought was like probably an hour and a half ago, the water is still leaving and it's still going. And
uh-oh.
Yeah, so we ended up getting stranded pretty much, to the point that we couldn't even kayak back. We had to hang our half of our body off the boat and just push it through the mud and like lean our front half
through
on
the muck.
Oh, it was miserable. It was absolutely miserable. We were just kind of trucking through. It was like the best ab workout I've ever had in my life, Christ. But you know, it definitely went on forever, and we were just pushing through it. And eventually at one point, my friend Nick sees this nudibranch, and we're like, I keep a list of everything. I'm really into invertebrate listing, so I was very interested in the nudibranch, and I had spent some time in Washington and doing dock fouling up in there, so I already had some nudibranchs on my lifer list and from diving as well. So I was eager. So we're like checking it out. We took a break. We needed a little bit of a break on this, and just kind of admiring it, taking some photos. We're like, okay, great. Let's keep going. And so we continue pushing through the muck, and eventually it starts getting deep enough that we can start getting in the boats and paddling a little bit. Again, it's pretty shallow, but we're managing to skeeve through it a little bit. And that's when I saw another nudibranch. And my friends were much further ahead of me at this point. And so I'm like, you know, I call them like, guys, there's another nudibranch. and they're like, does it look different? And it didn't look that different. It looked pretty much the same. So I like tried yelling back, no, you know, similar. It's maybe got a little bit of blue on the side. And then I think, you know, something along the lines of like, okay, well, we're going to continue. Let us know if you find one that's very different. So I took some photos of the Sanudibranch, and we didn't think much more of it. Or I didn't think much more of it. I just got some photos of it, and then we kept going. This paddle back, it just went on forever, and we weren't expecting to be out so late and having to push. We ended up getting back in the dark, and none of us had had headlamps or anything because we weren't planning on it. So it just started to get a little dark at the end there, or pretty dark at the end. I ended up having this like little emergency first aid light. So I just like held it in my mouth, and it was like maybe four feet of clearance ahead. But we were kind of just kayaking back in the dark, just using my light as a reference point. My favorite little memory of getting back though was because you've been to Flamingo, right? That's where we were coming back into. Have you seen the Crocs?
Right, I figured. Yep. Huge Crocs often right on the boat ramps there. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. There's never been an attack on, you know, I think there's actually only been one attack ever of a crocodile in the state of Florida, and it wasn't there. It's like the perfect setup for like a Jaws themed movie. It was like a party couple like jumping into the canal, skinny dipping, got bit by a crocodile, which is like the dumbest thing. You don't do that in Florida. But so there's never been incidents of it. But I was also like, how many people are coming back at night around when these guys are hunting? So I was probably a little more worried than either of them were. There's luckily there didn't end up being any reason to be. You know, they were fine. They kept to themselves. But it was this one little fun memory of coming back and just I was looking around with the light in my mouth, like absolutely ridiculous. And I could just see these eyes like shining back from the crocodiles around where we were, just like a little further behind, checking us out. So that certainly made it a little bit more interesting. And yeah, after all that, we never got the flamingo. So it ended up feeling a bit like a bust. Then the next day, we're kind of sitting at the diner. We're like, okay, what was that nudibranch? And we're going through it, and we're like, oh man, maybe it looks like it could be this one here, Dondis araneae, or araneae, I think is how you pronounce it. So we're looking at that, and we're like, wow, like, oh my God, this species was only described like 2 months ago. And we were like getting really excited by it. We're like, there's no way, like this is unbelievable. So we sent the picture that we had of the nudibranch we had all seen into this group chat for nudibranchs. And some guy gets back to us and he was like, no, it's not this one. It's this other one called Dondis occidentalis. I think that's what it ended up being, was occidentalis. But essentially a much more common widespread nudibranch. So we were all a little bit bummed, but then when we were reading about it, I was like, oh, the main difference between araneae and this occidentalis is that araneae, the one that's new to science or relatively new, has a little blue on the side. And I was like, ooh, that last one I saw did have a little blue on the side. So I sent it in to the group chat, and they ended up confirming it was this relatively new nudibranch. So I think that kind of made the grip hurt a little bit. They were like, oh,
yep. Your friends will never let you forget that.
No, well, I don't let them forget it. It's a great ongoing gag. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, you don't really care. Cause they didn't know any better. So they kept going, but I always rag on them for not turning back to see it. I'm like, yeah, you don't really care about lifers unless it's a bird anyways. Or so it's just, it's a pretty funny story though. I think just how close that we all were to getting it. And it ended up being this one that I didn't think much of, but I'm happy I took a photo of it. But this observation on iNat, I think it's like one of five, and it ended up being the most westward observation. So it's cool to kind of contribute that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. But I got the flamingos and the nudibranch just to make my friends a little sore about the whole situation. Yeah.
And never forget it.
Yeah, and they can't let them forget it. Because the other thing is they have this amazing luck at finding alligator lizards. And that's my favorite group of lizards. And I've never seen any alligator lizards despite trying multiple times. So it ends up evening out a little bit. I think when they mention that, I bring up the nudibranch. So it's all good. Yep. Yeah.
That's how those things go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, we should wrap it up, Zach. Yeah. I have to say, well, I've really appreciated chatting with you. It's definitely like shone some light on some aspects of Florida that I haven't thought about much. I just got back from there, and it makes me want to go back immediately. There clearly is so much to look for in the natural world there.
Right, yeah.
Chatting with you also, it just reminds me of just how there's endless exploration possible in the natural world, and just the deeper you go, the more you get out of it. You know, you can just go so deep on so many groups, whether it's nudibranchs or plants or in general or orchids or flowers, or I mean it's just endless.
Yeah.
And I think when you start down that road, you just realize that like life is never going to be boring, and there's something just really exciting about that. So mm-hmm. It sounds like you've really done that in Florida. That's very cool.
I appreciate it. Yeah, no, it's been an amazing time down here, and I have a lot of stuff to find, so it's definitely not getting bored.
Yeah, I know how that goes. I mean, I have so many things left to see in Madagascar, mostly herps. Not a lot of lemurs that of like really cool lemurs I haven't seen, but there are so many herps. A lot of them fossorial, ground dwelling, and you know, only out for a very short time in arid country.
Right.
So, but yeah, you know, it's inspiring that there's so much left to look for.
Yep.
For sure.
Well, it was great chatting with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, well, thanks for jumping on with short notice and just home from the tropics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we chatted about what natural sound would be appropriate, and you said you're favorite Florida bird is white-crowned pigeon. It's this real Caribbean bird that just gets into like far southern Florida, right?
Right.
So we'll play out with a white-crowned pigeon, recording by our friend Andrew Spencer. Hey, if people want to follow you, Zach, you're pretty active on social media, right?
Yeah, Instagram is best. I have a profile on Instagram where I do all my wildlife photography. It's Zach Babbitt Photography, ZAC. And then a period, BABBIT photography.
Yeah, I recommend checking out Zach's photography. He's a great photographer. He's got some great shots, and he was recently in Madagascar and got some sweet shots there.
Awesome, thank you.
Well, thanks again, Zach, and thanks to everybody for listening. And catch you next week.